From Pacifico Network, this is Democracy Now!
The poorest country in South America is now in the third week of an indigenous-led protest that's almost shut down the country. The issue, taking back public control of the nation's oil and gas.
Rebellion in Bolivia, as indigenous-led protests threaten to topple a U.S.-backed government in Latin America's poorest country, will go to Bolivia to speak with human rights activist Jim Schultz. Then, a conversation with Brazilian artist and founder of the Theater of the Oppressed, Augusto Boal.
I believe that the act of transforming the reality transforms she or he who acts. I don't have to be a poet to write a poem, but if I write a poem, I become a poet.
All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman, who's speaking at a conference in Italy. Now to today's top stories. Massive protests continue to spread across Latin America's poorest country, Bolivia. Late yesterday, the embattled U.S. President Carlos Mesa signed an emergency decree ordering a referendum on greater autonomy for the richest area of the country and a vote in mid-October to elect members for an assembly to write the Constitution. Mesa made the announcement late yesterday after the country's Congress failed to reach a consensus for the third day in a row, with indigenous-led protests raging in the streets of La Paz, bringing the capital to a standstill. The protests have cut off the capital from the airport, and blockades have shut down two-thirds of the country's highways. Meanwhile, the Bolivian Foreign Ministry rejected what it called international mediation after the U.S. State Department said Bolivia would be discussed at the Organization of American States General Assembly next week. Riot police armed with tear gas continue to guard Congress, and protests have spread to other areas in the country. Jim Schultz of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba reports that there are rumors of a coup in the air and said the protests, quote, show all the signs of growing more intense and bold in their willingness to shut the country down. We'll speak with Schultz in Bolivia in a moment. Now to the Middle East, where opposition groups in Lebanon are calling on President Emir Lahoud to resign over the killing of a leading journalist in Beirut yesterday. The journalist, Samir Khazar, was an opposition figure and a critic of Syrian influence in Beirut. He died yesterday after his car blew up when he turned the key in the ignition. President Lahoud has condemned the attack, and Syria has rejected opposition charges that it engineered Khazar's killing. We'll have more on this in a moment. Back in this country, President Bush has named conservative California Congress member Christopher Cox to run the Securities and Exchange Commission. His appointment is considered a great victory for big corporations who have donated tens of thousands of dollars to Cox over the years. Cox replaces William Donaldson, who disappointed many Republicans for showing some independence, often siding with Democrats on the commission. That is highly unlikely with Cox, who describes himself as a devoted student of Ayn Rand, a major promoter of unfettered capitalism. Cox has a long record in the House of promoting big business. He's a major recipient of contributions from business groups, the accounting profession, and Silicon Valley. He has fought against accounting rules that would give less favorable treatment to corporate mergers and executive stock options. He opposes taxes on dividends and capital gains, and he helped to steer through the House a bill making investor lawsuits more difficult. That measure, which Congress adopted over President Clinton's veto, was hailed by business groups. Consumer groups say it helped create the climate that fostered the big accounting scandals at companies like Enron and WorldCom. A federal judge has ordered the Pentagon to turn over dozens of photographs and four movies depicting abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq as part of an ongoing lawsuit brought by the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU's executive director, Anthony Romero, said, quote, "These images may be ugly and shocking, but they depict how the torture was more than the actions of a few rogue soldiers." The ACLU is calling for the appointment of an outside special counsel to investigate the torture and abuse of prisoners. The court order came in response to a Freedom of Information lawsuit filed by the ACLU, the New York Civil Liberties Union, and the Center for Constitutional Rights. Meanwhile, the head of Amnesty International, Irene Khan, called on the United States to open its detention centers at Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere to human rights investigators if it wants to disprove allegations of abuse. Khan was responding to the Bush administration's dismissal of the group's allegation that the U.S. was running a gulag, and she defended the use of that word, gulag, in particular. Here is Irene Khan speaking yesterday.
What we wanted to do was to send a strong message that Guantanamo, Bagram, and this sort of network of prison detention centers that have been created as part of this war on terror is actually undermining human rights in a dramatic way.
That was Irene Khan, the head of Amnesty International. An appeals court has ruled that the city of Seattle had the right to create a restricted area, the so-called no-protest zone in downtown Seattle during the 1999 protests of the World Trade Organization. The case is being heard as part of a series of lawsuits stemming from the protests. The decision from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overturns a lower court decision challenging the restricted zone as a violation of the right to freedom of assembly and freedom of speech. The case now moves to a federal court in Seattle to determine if the constitutional rights of protesters were violated on an individual basis. The case is considered an important one for First Amendment rights. Some legal observers believe it will set a precedent for litigation resulting from various demonstrations around the U.S. where protesters have been barred from certain locations during major demonstrations in New York, Philadelphia, Miami, and Washington, D.C. And nearly 50 years after Emmett Till's mutilated body was found in a Mississippi river, federal investigators this week unearthed the Chicago teen's casket in hopes of finding clues to a murder that helped kindle the civil rights movement. Mississippi prosecutors and the FBI have said DNA or other evidence might help determine who killed the 14-year-old and whether anyone still alive should be prosecuted. Two white men charged with the murder were acquitted by an all-white jury. The two, now dead, later confessed to beating and shooting Till, saying in a magazine article that they killed the teenager because he had whistled at one of their wives. The Justice Department announced plans last year to reopen the Till investigation. Whatever may be your birth sign, we are not of the same seed. Although we are both the same breed, together we're truly black power. Power. Learning to trust by the hour. Power. Loving our women now more. Now more. Respecting what death is now for. And we've got. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is in Italy attending a conference and will be back on Monday. We turn now to the Middle East. A prominent anti-Syrian journalist was killed by a car bomb yesterday in Beirut, the capital of Lebanon. Samir Kazer was a longtime columnist at the major daily newspaper An-Nahar. In 2001, Syrian security forces seized Kazer's passport and threatened to arrest him for criticizing Syria and the police state in Lebanon. Today, journalists, politicians, and supporters held an hour-long silent sit-in in central Beirut's main square. Kazer was the highest-profile assassination target since Lebanese former Prime Minister Rafik al-Hariri was killed in February of this year. Massive protests following Hariri's death forced Syria to remove its troops stationed in Lebanon, ending a 29-year military occupation. Opposition leaders accused the Syrian government and its supporters in Lebanon of carrying out the killings of both Hariri and Kazer. Lebanese President Emil Lahoud is a strong supporter of the Syrian presence in Lebanon. Parliamentary elections going on now will likely make Hariri's son, Saad, prime minister, but will not go far to encourage Lahoud to resign. We're joined now on the phone by Hisham Mellem, correspondent for An-Nahar in Washington, D.C., and host of Across the Ocean, a talk show on Al Arabiya satellite television. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, your reaction to this assassination, and if you could talk to us a little bit about your colleague, Samir Kazer.
Well, of course, this is a tremendous personal loss for us. Samir was a friend and a great colleague and a powerful voice for democracy and freedom in Lebanon. He was a sharp analyst, witty. He had that kind of intellectual integrity that only people who have a great sense of tragedy, if you will, would have, knowing the limitation of political systems and people's yearning for a perfect democracy as possible. He fought the good fight. He was an egalitarian. He was a genuine Democrat. And in the last few years, he became one of the founding members of the democracy movement that we've seen in the last few months in the squares and streets of Beirut that led that forced the Syrians to withdraw their army. He was a thorn, if you will, in the side of what we call in Lebanon today the security intelligence system that has been abusing the Lebanese and the Syrian people for so many years.
And your response to the call by opposition leaders for President Lahoud's resignation?
I think the President Lahoud, who owes his position to the Syrians, who forced the Lebanese parliament a few months ago in September to extend his term for three more years, I think his political life is essentially over, and it's a question of time when he will be forced to resign. He reminds the Lebanese that he represents the remnant of that Syrian presence and abuse of Lebanon that's been going on for so many years. He lacks legitimacy. Under his watch, all of these killings and assassinations are happening, and he sits in his wonderful isolation in his palace doing nothing about it, other than just giving excuses for it. And this is a man who's seen as not representing the will of the Lebanese people, but representing the will of the Syrian regime in Lebanon. And I think it's a question of time when he will be driven out.
The independent journalist Robert Fisk wrote last week that George Bush's demand that the parliamentary elections be held, quote, on time, meant that there was no opportunity of making them fairer than they are now under the Syrian-imposed election districts. What's your response to Fisk's analysis?
There is some truth there in the sense that the electoral law that under which these elections are taking place was imposed by the Syrians essentially in the year 2000 to make it possible for their allies to win in Lebanon. They came up with their own version of gerrymandering, if you will. But we did not have enough time, unfortunately, to come up with an electoral law that is acceptable to most parties. And I think from the perspective of the international community, particularly, to put it bluntly, the Americans and the French, delaying the election creates at least the potential for postponing them indefinitely. And there was this view that unless we have the elections now, the international pressure on the Syrians and their Lebanese allies will diminish with the passage of time. And there are many Lebanese politicians, unfortunately, who cannot be trusted if they give you their word. So what we're hoping for now is that some of those old members of the old guard, if you will be swept away by the elections. But definitely, this is not a very good electoral law that we have right now.
And given the huge contending demonstrations that have been occurring in Lebanon over the last several months, what is your sense of the prospects for a peaceful and constitutional solution to the differences in the country vis-a-vis some of the past civil war period that Lebanon went through?
Well, the popular phenomena that you've seen a few months ago in Beirut represents the beginning or the emergence of a new majority in Lebanon. Unfortunately, that new majority in Lebanon is still led and manipulated by some of the old guard, by an exclusive club of former militia people, big, large aristocratic political families. And also the Lebanese, after the end of the civil war and because of the Syrian presence, did not do what the South Africans did, for instance, after the collapse of the apartheid, in which they established the Commission for Truth and Reconciliation to exorcise their own demons, if you will, and to really deal morally and politically and legally with the causes of the civil war. So they've postponed that, unfortunately, and that's why we're still suffering from some of the effects of a bygone conflict. At least now with the Syrians out, the possibility of real political reform is there, and it's up to the Lebanese to sort out their own differences politically and peacefully to come up with a new formula that most Lebanese will feel comfortable with.
Well, I want to thank you, Hisham Mellem, correspondent for the Lebanese newspaper An-Nahar in Washington, D.C., and host of Across the Ocean, a talk show on Al Arabiya satellite television, for being with us, and our condolences on the assassination, the death of your colleague and friend, Samir Khazer. We move now to Latin America. Rebellion is in the air in Latin America's poorest country, Bolivia. For weeks, indigenous-led protests have rocked the country and have brought the government to a near shutdown. The protests began as demonstrations calling for the nationalization of the country's natural gas resources, but that was just a spark for a much bigger war, a war over the rights of the country's majority indigenous population. The U.S.-backed president, Carlos Mesa, is scrapping to maintain control of the government, and there are rumors that of a coup plot. Late yesterday, Mesa signed an emergency decree ordering a referendum on greater autonomy for the richest area of the country and a vote in mid-October to elect members for an assembly to rewrite the Constitution. The protests have cut off the capital from the airport and blockades have shut down two-thirds of the country's highways. We go now to Bolivia, where we are joined by Jim Schultz, the executive director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba. He writes a blog on the developments in Bolivia that can be found at democracyctr.org. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for continuing to keep this important story alive in the United States and for your other listeners.
Well, the story has gotten very little coverage here in the corporate press. I'd like to get some sense from you what's been going on in the last 24 hours and your sense of some of the underlying factors that haven't yet surfaced.
Well, let's start with sort of looking at what's happening on the ground. To orient people, the capital of Bolivia, La Paz, is this city of a million people, basically at the base of a bowl, 12,000 feet high. It is surrounded by this plain, 2,000 feet higher than that, called El Alto in the Altiplano, outside of that. What has happened for the last 2.5 weeks is the indigenous Aymara communities from the Altiplano and from the twin poorer city of El Alto have descended onto the capital and essentially shut it down. There isn't food coming in and out. There isn't bus transport in or out. A number of the airlines have canceled their flights. And there's, 10, 20,000 people that have been coming in every day and trying to literally shut the government down by taking over the heart of the city, which is Plaza Murillo, where the Congress and the presidential palace are located. This has spread to other parts of the country as well. Here in Cochabamba, the center of the city has been blockaded now every day for the last 3 days. There's limited bus transport out of Cochabamba today as well. All of this is aimed at forcing the government to take back control of the nation's oil and gas resources, which were privatized under IMF pressure in the mid-1990s. And really what's happening is this is the end of a process that has been in motion for more than 2 years. This is the same issue over which Bolivia kicked out its last president, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, in very similar uprisings in October of 2003.
But at the same time, there's also a developing autonomy movement in the richest state or province of Bolivia. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of what's going on here is traditionally the mineral resources of this country, silver, tin, have been in the highlands where the indigenous communities are strongest and most represented. The oil and gas, and we're talking about a lot of oil and gas, we're talking about 53 trillion with a T cubic feet. This is the second largest reserve on the continent after Venezuela. This is a lot of natural gas. It's in Santa Cruz Tarija. It's in the other side of the country, the lowlands, the jungle lands as well, which is a wealthier part of the country. The response to the demand by the people in the highlands for nationalization and public control has been an effort, especially in the province of Santa Cruz, to demand autonomy, essentially to demand that the national government stay out of certain affairs. And it doesn't take a lot of reading between the lines to understand what it's really about is the people who are sitting on the land where the gas is located really want to make sure that they get the biggest share and the most control. And the oil companies have very clearly been manipulating this. This is not an uprising in Santa Cruz of the poor. This is an uprising of the business class. And it is very simple for foreign oil companies to manipulate that process and foment that discontent. And so, it's interesting. Every time the indigenous community has an uprising, the U.S. government likes to blame it on narco traffickers, but they don't seem to pay attention much to the fact that you have this uprising on the other side of the country for autonomy that has oil company fingerprints all over it.
We're talking with Jim Schultz, the executive director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia. He writes a blog on developments in Bolivia that can be found at democracyctr.org. We're going to return and talk with him about the role of the United States and the IMF in the current crisis in Bolivia. But first, we're going to take a break so that stations can identify themselves. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. We're talking right now on the phone with Jim Schultz, the executive director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia, about the crisis in Bolivia. Jim, could you talk to us a little bit about the U.S. role in the current crisis and in Bolivian politics in general and that of the IMF? You've been writing quite a bit about that on your blog that can be found at democracycenter.org. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, Juan, it's important to put the story in the context both of sort of U.S. and IMF policy, but also in what's happening in Latin America more broadly. Bolivia has, for the past 20 years, been the lab rat for the IMF's and the World Bank's economic policies. And Bolivia did it all. Privatization of water, privatization of oil and gas, relaxation of labor standards, all of the deficit reduction financed on the backs of the poor, all of this has been done at the command of the IMF and the World Bank. I mean, Bolivia doesn't have a lot of choice. When the IMF and the World Bank tell Bolivia, thou shalt privatize your water or thou shalt privatize your oil and gas, those are commandments that are very difficult for a poor country like Bolivia to say no to. And the fact is, it hasn't worked. I mean, this is a country that has had two major civic uprisings over water privatization, both of which have kicked big international companies out of the country. And now it's having this uprising over gas privatization. It just hasn't worked. And I think this is related to what's happening all over Latin America. If you think about the last 30 years in Latin America, South America in particular, you know, we went in the period in the 60s and 70s of right-wing dictatorships and left-wing insurgencies. And then we went through a period of elected governments that were very conservative, very tied to the United States, and very dedicated to the policies of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And what's happening now is this movement from the left to, you know, take over governments in Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela through the political process, and in the streets in Bolivia, it is a practical rebellion against the practical failure of the economic policies imposed on these countries from abroad by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. We just released a report in April called Deadly Consequences, which people can find in its entirety on our website, the small book, that traces very clearly how the International Monetary Fund demands in this country 2 years ago for tax increases to reduce its deficit, to pay its foreign debtors off more quickly, how that descended into 34 people being killed in the country's capital, a shooting war between the police and the army in front of the National Palace, directly the result of IMF economic policy. So what's happening in Bolivia is not just the story of Bolivia. It is absolutely the story of Latin America and South America, and it is the story of indigenous peoples rising up against a set of economic ideologies imposed on them completely against their will, completely without their consent from institutions abroad.
Well, Jim, in your analysis, why has this been happening at this particular time? Is it that Latin America moved forward with the neoliberal program faster than other parts of the world, and therefore the populations began to recognize sooner the total bankruptcy of that approach? Is it that the United States and the Bush administration are so distracted and overextended by their battle to control the Middle East that they haven't been paying attention? What's been the particular reasons, in your opinion, why it seems to be the whole continent, the Democratic vote in the whole continent is rapidly turning against U.S. policies?
I think it is a very practical rebellion against the effect of these policies. And this is important to note because, you know, the new article du jour of the press is to talk about the rise of the left in South America. And this is not the second coming of Che Guevara. This is not even an ideological rebellion. It's more interesting than that. You know, I live in this country. I've lived here for 8 years. These are my neighbors. By and large, people who live on the margin don't have the luxury of ideology. What they want is practical solutions to their practical problems, like can they get water? Can they find a job? And what's happening is people in Bolivia in particular, and it's the same trend in Brazil. I was just there not long ago. People are basically saying this whole package of economic policies, it isn't working. It hasn't delivered the goods. If it had, if privatization of water, for example, had delivered water, if privatization of oil and gas had actually increased public revenues and made it possible to lift up people's lives, I think people here would have embraced it. That's the point to me that's the most important, is what's going on is a reaction to these policies that is not rooted in ideology, by and large. It is rooted in the absolute practical failure of those policies to do anything but make the lives of the poor more miserable.
And the current situation now in Bolivia, if President Mesa is forced out of office, given the fact that you have a very strong right-wing autonomy movement in the richest province and that Evo Morales, the popular leader, has been almost sidelined by this indigenous revolt that continues to grow, what do you see as the potential developments that could occur once Mesa steps down, if he does?
Right. Well, you know, there's an expression in Bolivia that people use a lot called todo es posible, everything is possible. And usually when people say it, they mean, can you bring a 1982 Corolla, a Toyota Corolla, back to life after it's died? Now when people say todo es posible, they're talking about politics and everything is possible. We could have a coup. That's entirely possible, although I'm optimistic that that won't happen. We could have the conflict in the streets turn deadly and violent. That has happened. I think that the most likely scenario at this point is the following. I think that there will be some negotiation through which there is the convening of an Asamblea Constituyente, and we haven't talked about that, that the president has called for it in October. We need to see the details. But I think there'll be some sort of settlement in which this issue of gas will be turned over to a constituent assembly elected at large from the grassroots across the country, and that that's where the gas issue will be decided. And the side issue to that is to make sure that this call for autonomy doesn't preempt some national decision-making about how to develop the gas. I think we're headed towards some sort of a negotiated settlement. That is generally what happens here. Usually the Catholic Church, the Human Rights Assembly step in and are able to sort of pull people together. We're at the brink of not being able to do that, but I suspect that's where this will go.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Jim Schultz, the Executive Director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia. He writes a blog on developments in Bolivia that can be found at democracyctr.org. His latest book is called Deadly Consequences, the International Monetary Fund and Bolivia's Black February. This is Democracy Now!, and now we're going to go to nearby Brazil. And we are joined in our studio, in our firehouse studio here, by one of the extraordinary people's artists of Latin America. We go to Brazilian artist and activist Augusto Boal, who sees theater as a dialogue and an opportunity to act out social change. Drawing on Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed, Boal developed Theater of the Oppressed out of his experimental work at the Arena Theater in Sao Paulo during the 1950s and 60s. Boal took the theater to factories and farms throughout Brazil and developed plays around the experiences of people silenced by poverty and oppression. Boal's plays were increasingly censored by the government, and in 1971, the military dictatorship imprisoned him for 4 months. When he was released, he was forced into exile and spent 15 years in Argentina, Portugal, and France before returning to Rio. Theater of the Oppressed techniques, from, quote, invisible theater on the streets to solution-oriented forum theater, spread around the world. Boal is in New York this week running a theater workshop at the Brecht Forum, and he joins us now in our studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you. Talk to us about how you got started in the 1950s in using theater and art to open up and explain and help folks in Brazil be able to deal with their social conditions.
Yeah. In the 50s, I did not do Theater of the Oppressed. I did theater like everybody else, in which you call the spectator to come, you charge a price for the ticket, and then you do plays the best that you can. But soon I understood that I was doing good plays, wonderful plays for people that were good writers, for an audience that came just to look at it and say, okay, it's nice. And then they went away and nothing else happened. And always, for me, theater should be more than that. Shakespeare used to say, but he said in Hamlet that the theater should be and is like a mirror, in which we look at the mirror and then we see our vices and our virtues. I think that's very nice, but I would like to have a mirror with some magic properties, in which we could, if we don't like the image that we have in front of us, to allow allow us to penetrate into that mirror and then transform our image and then come back with our image transformed. The act of transforming, I always say, transforms she or he who acts. So to use theater as a rehearsal for transformation of reality. This was my idea, but not my practice until the dictatorship was every time more severe on us and started forbidding our plays, not allowing us to do our plays, to do nothing. So when we lost our theater, we lost everything, we found theater.
This would have been the military dictatorship of the late 60s? And
yeah, it started from 64, and then it lasted until 80 and something, and some structures are still there. It is, we talk about now we have democracy. What kind of democracy? Democracy is a word that you can fill in with what whatever you want. I believe that words, they are like trucks. They are like means of transportation. You can put inside what you want. And democracy, we call democracy many countries in which you have to choose between two people that are very rich and buy time on the television, or you call democracy Greece, in which the women did not vote. We call democracy anything. We say that now in Brazil we have democracy, but that's not true. Half of the population cannot read or write. Half of the population live under the poverty limit of life, so that's not democracy.
Paulo Freire, you've been, many people have said you began to implement in theater some of his ideas and perspectives. Can you talk about how you began to develop the forum theater and your theater of the oppressed?
Yeah, Paulo Freire was a very good friend of mine, and he started more or less in the 60s. Once we were talking to try to remember when we have met for the first time, we do not remember well. We had the impression that we have met for all our lives. And his work inspired me, of course, and they developed parallel one to another. But, of course, he wrote The Pedagogy of the Paris first, and my title, Theater of the Press, is a homage to him. No, well, how it started, when I was in the 70s, I was already persecuted by the police, by the army, by all of them, and then I could not do theater anymore. So I said, I cannot give the population the artistic product read. So what I'm going to do is to try to give them the means of production. Then me and a group of my colleagues of the Arena Theater, we started developing what we call the newspaper theater, in which we would translate news from the newspaper into scenes, of theatrical scenes. But we would teach them how to do it, but we would not do for them. So we wanted to democratize the means of production. Then we developed lots of groups that did newspaper theater about their own problems. We worked in factories, we worked in churches, because in Brazil there is a church which is very reactionary, but there is also a church which is very progressive, the theology of liberation and all that. Well, then we start doing that. I was arrested in 71, and then I had to leave the country, and then I went to Argentina. In Argentina, I had to do something also, and I like to do theater in the street. But my friend said, don't do theater in the street, because if you got arrested again here in Argentina, they will to send you back to Brazil. And in Brazil, they did not arrest the same person twice. The second time, they killed directly. So someone had a good idea. He said, why don't we do the play, but we don't tell anybody that it is a play? So you can be there, and no one is responsible for anything, because you explode the scene in front of everyone. Everyone can participate. So we did that. We did what they called invisible theater. We went to a restaurant. It was a law that said that no Argentine could die from hunger, and if an Argentine had the right to go into any restaurant and eat whatever they wanted, but not drink wine, not take dessert. The rest, he could ask for 2-3 beefsteaks, and it would be okay. And then signed the bill and showed the identity card in which they proved that they were Argentine. So I said, okay, let's go to a real restaurant instead of spending money to make the settings and spending money to make propaganda. Let's go to a real restaurant and play the play there. And then me, Augusto, I was sitting far away in another table eating my beef. When we exploded the scene, everyone participated. And then it was very nice because the actor became the spectator of the spectator who had become an actor. So the fiction and reality were overlapping. You know? That was in Argentina.
What was the reaction?
The reaction is always very good because we never create violence. We want to reveal the violence that exists in society. We don't want to duplicate. We don't want to bring our violence, but just to show society is violent. If there is people who is dying from hunger and food is plenty, why should they die? So we try to show the absurdity of the system in which we live. You know?
And was the invisible theater... actors, did you train more people to do it, or was it basically a small core that all around the country?
In this beginning of the Theater of the Press, they were both. They were people, citizens, normal citizens, who wanted to make a theatrical experience, and some professional actors also. Today, I work with both, but separately. I have worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company, working in plays by Shakespeare to try to show them some of the techniques of the theater of the press, interiorized techniques, no? But that's something. And something else is to work with everybody, because we believe that everybody can do theater. Everybody can do what one person can do, everyone can do. But not the same way, not with the same skills, but everyone can do with the same sincerity and the same means of expression.
Well, we're talking with Augusto Boal, the founder of Brazil's Theater of the Oppressed. We're going to take a break for 60 seconds for stations to identify themselves, and then we'll be back with him. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman, who is in Italy, speaking at an event there in Italy today. We're joined by Augusto Boal, who's the founder of the Theater of the Oppressed movement in Brazil and globally. Boal is the author of several books, including his 2001 autobiography, Hamlet and the Baker's Son: My Life in Theater and Politics. And we're welcome back so we can Thank continue you. The conversation. Could you talk to us about the Forum Theater? What is the Forum Theater, and how did that develop?
The Forum Theater is exactly the image of the mirror. No, we present the problem because sometimes we know what the problem is. All of us agree we have this problem. So, for instance, the workers that go to claim for better conditions of work or better salaries or whatever, everyone agrees. But how to do it, we don't know. So what we do? We present the play, whatever the theme is, whatever the problem is, we present the play, and then we look at like normal spectators. But at the end, we say, okay, this ended in failure. So how could we change the events? Everything is going to change in society, in our biological life. Everything is always changing. Nothing is going to stay the way it is. All is going to, so how can we change this for better? And then we start again the same play, and we invite the audience to, at any time that they want to say stop, go to replace the protagonist punished and show alternatives. So we learn from one another. You have in a scene the wrong solution, the wrong way. And then we try to see what is the right way. We don't know. We don't do the political theater of the 50s in which we had the propaganda, you had an idea, you have a message. We don't have the message. We have the questions. We bring the what can we do? And democratically, everyone can say stop and jump on the scene and try a solution or an alternative. And then we discuss that alternative and then a second, a third, as many as people are there. So what we want is to develop the capacity of people to create, to use their intelligence, to use their sensibility. Because we live in a society which is very imperative, who says all of the time, do this, go that way, dress this way, eat that. And we don't want the orders. We don't want the imperative mood. We want to the subjunctive theater. And you say, how would it be if it were like that? Then we ask the people, we bring questions. We don't bring certitudes. But the questions, the doubts, are the seed of certitudes, then some certitude comes out. But it is from everyone. Everyone has the right to speak their word and to act their thoughts, not only to talk about, but to act their thoughts.
What has been the impact of the Theater of the Oppressed on the established theater or artistic movements within Brazil and in Latin America?
Yeah. I started doing that in Peru, in reality, when I was already in exile. I was directing the part of theater because the government at that time was a military government, but strangely enough, it was center-left. And they wanted to make programs of literacy programs, and I was in charge of the theater. So I started doing there. Now it's all over the world. We have in the web page, which is Theater of the Oppressed altogether .org, no theater, but like the English write theater, not theater.
Yes.
No, of the oppressed. Or we have 48 countries, but we know of more than 70 countries in which they do Theater of the Oppressed. But all of them in their own themes. We don't tell them you have to do about this or that. For example, in India, they have an enormous movement. And what they do is about hunger, it's about unemployment, it's about the living conditions of their lives. But at the same time, you have also in Paris. So in Paris, they treat problems. In New York, here, we have the Brecht Forum has a Theater of the Oppressed laboratorium. And what do they discuss? The problems of New York, the problems of the United States, the problems of the relation of the United States, the government of the United States with the rest of the world. You know? We have in Nebraska, permanent center also, and we have Los Angeles. That's where I met Amy Goodman. She came to my lecture, and I went to her lecture, so we met there. So it's all over. It's very nice because it's a way of using theater in a dynamic way, not in a receptive way only, but in a dynamic way. To give you an example, which is a very beautiful example, we have many groups in Rio. We have groups of slums, of poor places, no poor communities.
Favelas,
yes. We have groups of teachers. We have lots of groups. And one of them is a group of housemaids. They are all called Maria. Maria this, Maria that, Maria something. They are called Marias of Brazil. And then they are housemaids, real housemaids. They work like a housemaid, and the only day free they have is Sunday. So they come to the theater and they practice the theater. They present their plays. And once they wanted to do theater inside the theater. They said, what you tell us is that we do theater, but we play in churches, we play in the streets, we play everywhere, but not in a theater. We want to go in a theater. And I said, yes, but if we go there, we are not going to have the rituals of the theater in which you pay tickets. You have to offer the tickets. And they said, no, but we want to see the curtain going up. We want to be in a real building. And then we did that. They were very happy. It was a great success, and at the end, they came to tell me that one of them was weeping after the show. And I said, but why? It was such a big success. They applauded so much. I asked her, why did you weep? And she said, look, it is very moving for us because we who work in house for the other people, we are supposed to be invisible. We should not appear. We should do everything, but not be present. And then today I was rehearsing, and there was a man throwing lights on me and say, come here so that we can see your body. We are taught to be mute. And there was a man putting a microphone here to, so that I could be heard. And I said, that's why you wept? And she said, no, it was in the show. I was playing there. I was showing my emotions, showing my thoughts and all that. And the family I worked for in 10 years, they were all there in the theater, sitting silent, looking at me and in the dark. Mm-hmm. And I was there. I said, that's why you wept. And she said, no. I said, why did you weep? And she said, because when I went back to the dressing room, I looked at the mirror. And then I was afraid. I said, what did you see in the mirror? And she said, I saw a woman. And I said, but it's normal. If you look at the mirror, you see a woman. When I look at the mirror to shave, I see a man. And she said, no, but that was the first time I saw a woman in the mirror. And I said, but what did you see before? And she said, before I saw a housemaid, and now I saw a woman. So the theater, by the fact that you go there and you show your ideas, you show your emotions, you show what your desires are, give you the right to have your own identity and not to keep the identity that they put on you. We all wear masks in society. In the theater, you take off the mask and you are yourself. That's the great advantage of the theater, especially the theater of the oppressed, in which you can do that.
In your autobiography, you call it Hamlet and the Baker's Son, My Life in Theater and Politics. The title.
Yeah. The title is because my father was a baker. I worked with him very much when I was a child. And because I am Hamlet. I am always to be or not to be. I am a man of the theater, and I work with people who are not in the theater. I work with the peasants without land in Brazil. It's a very big movement. They are not artists. And I say, yes, you are. Then I convince them that they are artists, and they are artists. And then they show their art. So I'm always doing theater professionally because I want to show. I think that everyone can do theater, even actors. And theater can be done everywhere, even inside theater. So I want to be a director because I'm not an actor, and I want to use theater in a conventional way also, but I am the other side, what interests me more, as citizen, because I think that sometimes people say, you are politically minded or not. It's not you as an artist, it's you as a citizen. If I'm not, we're not a man of the theater, if I were a dentist, a veterinarian, if I were a doctor, if I were a worker, I had as a citizen to take a party, to say, well, I believe in this, let's change things in that way. So to be politically minded is a necessity of the citizen, not of the artist solely.
Your life in politics as well. You were a member of the Brazilian Workers' Party. That party is now in power in Brazil and in the person of President Lula. What your sense of how Brazil, the most important country in Latin America in size and wealth and population, how what have been the changes over the last few years under the Workers' Party?
I don't agree that we are in power. We are in the government.
Okay.
And the government has not the power that it wanted. I believe that there are many things that Lula and the government is doing which are extremely important. For instance, the treatment of the Hunger Zero, the program called Hunger Zero, in which they distribute, yes, it's assistentialism in some way, but they distribute money for people who are starving, and that's important. It's important even economically, because the money that you give to a person who is starving is going to buy he's going to buy food. It's not the same that if you distribute dividends, because it's going to be speculative money. So it's very important that that program, and it's very important for the families that have not salary, not at all, that live with less than $1 a day. Suddenly they can eat beans and rice, which is the national food. And that's good. I think that the external politics of Brazil is also extremely important, what they are doing. Lula, a few weeks ago, organized a meeting between the Arab countries and the South American countries. We are having ties with Argentina, with Venezuela, with Uruguay, which are more progressive governments too. So we are having contact with India. I think it's very important not to have only a bilateral relation with the United States, but to have with other countries too, to expand our relations. This is extremely important. What I don't find so important, what I find it's not sufficient, is, for instance, the external debt. We have paid the debt several times already as interest. And the debt has to be verified if it really exists. When Getúlio Vargas, decades ago, made an examination of the money that we were paying to the external banks, it was found out that we did not owe really not even half of what we were paying. And now the situation is the same. We don't owe what we are paying. We did not borrow that money. It was the dictatorship that borrowed, and not all. There are not the evidence, there are not the documents to prove that we owe so much money. So there, Lula has not touched this, it goes on paying. And we know that in the economy, there are absurdities that are taken for granted. For instance, what they call the risk country. It is the banks that lend the money, the banks decide if the country has a risk or not. In a unilateral way, they decide that you are running the risk of not being capable of paying your debt. So they raise the interest. Instead of lowering, they raise, and then you pay. If you paid, it was because you could pay, but they decide that you were a risk. Then you pay, and even so, they don't give you back the money. So they decide, it is, you borrow some money, you don't know how much you are going to pay. And this for centuries. And what I believe is that a debt that cannot be paid because they are extremely big and they cannot be paid, they become a link of slavery. So we became a slave country. We are paying in the banks. We are giving money to the banks. If we don't cut this bond of slavery, we are going on all of the time protesting because the salaries are low, because education not enough, health is worse, and that the part of the government that is not working.
Let me ask you, we discussed earlier in the show, and you heard the discussion on Bolivia, the enormous changes that are occurring throughout Latin America politically compared to even 10 years ago or 5 years ago, which Brazil is a part. These elections that are bringing to power much more progressive or at least rebellious governments vis-a-vis the United States. And what do you think is happening to the everyday Latin American in terms of the enormous changes of the last few years?
I heard in the interview that you made a while ago a phrase that is very dear to my heart. He said, everything is possible. All is possible. That's what we don't believe. We believe that the things the way they are is the only thing that realistically we can, the only way realistically we can think it can be. But it's not true. The truth is what we heard in this program. Everything is possible. And then if we have in our minds that everything can be transformed, another world is possible, like in the forum, social forum, Porto Alegre, they said, we start preparing the change. If we believe, oh, that's the way it is, fatalistically, then nothing is going to happen. I believe in transformation. I believe that we say in the Theater of the Press that in the present we have to analyze the past, but to invent the future is not to analyze the past, to contemplate the past and say, oh, in the past it was like that. It is to think about the future and not believe that, that's the law or that legality or that's moral, because slavery was moral. A century ago or more, slavery was moral, was legal. You could have the property of a person, of a human being. Then you have to transform it. One thing is moral. The other thing is ethics. They are not the same. Moral is the way things are. It's legality. But legitimacy is an ethic. drive. You have to think about another world in which there will be more fraternity, there will be more solidarity, and not so much competition, so too much, I want to be the first, I want to... We have to be all the first, not only to run a race and be the first and then look back and, oh, the other ones are far away, good for me. No.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Augusto Boal, the founder of the Theater of the Oppressed, which is now an international movement. He's here visiting in New York for a while. He's the author of several books, including his 2001 autobiography, Hamlet and the Baker's Son. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Kadus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Nell Geiser, and Jeremy Scale. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Lurie Gall, Angela Alston, Chris Zucker, and the whole team that makes this show possible. You can visit us on the web at democracynow.org. Sitting in for Amy Goodman, I'm Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!